Welcome to Civil Discourse. This podcast will use government documents to illuminate the workings of the American government and offer context around the effects of government agencies in your everyday life. And now your hosts, Nia Rogers, Public Affairs Librarian, and Dr. John Augenbaugh, Political Science Professor.
Hey, Augie.
Good morning, Nia. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Listeners, another exciting podcast episode, of course, because all of our podcast episodes are exciting.
Yes, even the boring ones.
Particularly, we have joining us once again, Eric Johnson from the VCU Libraries. Eric is with us today to discuss the Smithsonian, okay, which... For geeks like me and I, it ranks right up there, does it not, Nia, with some of our, you know, most favorite institutions like in the world?
Oh,
right?
Yeah, because the Smithsonian, in my mind, the Smithsonian and the Louvre and the British Museum, right, like those are just world-class institutions. And so when everybody says in the world, America's a bit backwards, we can say Smithsonian really quickly to try to sort of counteract the backwardsness thing. Eric, is that how you perceive it?
I mean, what I was almost going to jump in and say is, not only is it great, but it's free compared to your stupid Louvre.
Yeah, that's true, right? with your pyramid-y pretend thing and your Tom Hanks movies. So
and for me, since I like, you know, titles and labels and catchy phrases, right? The Smithsonian, right? The nation's attic. Okay. You know,
would ever call the Louvre France's attic. Do you know what I mean? Like, they just wouldn't.
Right. Okay. And as we get into this discussion, Eric is going to talk to us about the castle, right? I mean, there are parts of the Smithsonian, okay, that you're just like, wow, right? I mean, you could go ahead and like do an entire movie. Okay. Yeah. Tom Hanks. Okay. you know, the Louvre. Okay, let's go ahead and spend a little quality time, okay, doing a movie, okay, with the Smithsonian. Thank you very much, okay? But anyways, Eric, like with our discussion with you about the national parks, I'm fascinated by your interest in the Smithsonian. So if you could start off the episode by talking with us about your interest in what got you excited about the Smithsonian?
Actually, it sort of starts off like I did the National Park one, which is, again, growing up in Northern Virginia, it was way easy. Like, the Smithsonians were our sort of like local museum, you know, all school trips practically felt like they were going to the Smithsonian in some fashion, you know, one museum or another, depending on the nature of the class or that kind of thing. Back when schools used to have school trips, which of course is now no longer the case, and unfortunately so many ways, but and also my dad worked for the metro system. He was an electrical engineer for the metro system, and so we would go downtown, you know, pretty regularly, you know, take the bus to the subway and the subway down downtown and go to the mall and visit stuff, and so I really grew up hitting a bunch of different museums just over time. I had a real interest in natural history, so it was easy to go to the Natural History Museum there. And so my first, like, you know, that was my childhood, but then also my first summer job, because I had such a great experience visiting Smithsonian stuff, was at the National Zoo. That I worked at the zoo my basically last two summers of high school and first two summers of college. My very first jobs were selling ice cream out of ice cream stands at the zoo. So including one to Jay Schrader, former quarterback of the Washington Redskins.
Oh,
hey.
Yes, yeah. That was very exciting. He is a very big man compared to my little high school self. So, you know, it was like two summers, second summer boiling up on, it was one of those summers where there were multiple 100-degree days and, you know, up at the top entrance of the zoo, huge blacktop area, me in a little stand, you know, selling out the ice cream and then drinks and that sort of thing. But then the second two summers I was there, I was in the education department. So I got to work at the information desks. So doing the fun thing of, you know, answering questions as people came in, or like I did the elephant cart, the elephant information cart by the elephant exhibit and in the elephant house, where we had models or, you know, casts of elephant poop that we would like hold up to show people to talk about elephant diet and that sort of thing. So
how big is okay. that?
Okay, we got to stop right there. Okay, that's a first for our podcast. Okay, a reference to elephant poop.
And an expert in elephant poop.
Well done, Eric.
Okay. Yes.
I am here for you.
You are taking us to August Heights. Okay. That's
right. How big is an elephant poop?
Well, I mean, the piece that we showed, you know, which was cast, I mean, which I love is like the company that has to mold these and paint them. Like, good on them. But, you know, it's, I don't know, it was probably 8 inches by 5 or 6 inches kind of
okay
cylindrical-ish kind of shape. And then we also had a piece of hide and some, you know, some other stuff that we were showing people what they ate, all that kind of good thing as well. But, and then it's sort of my last formal experience with them was in, after my junior year in college, I did an internship at the American History Museum. The Field to Factory exhibit at American History, which is the big exhibit that was built in the late 80s about the Great Migration. So the you know, sort of migration of Southern rural Blacks to, you know, urban North, you know, sort of the real change in American demographic pattern. So moving from rural South to urban North, what they did was had this exhibit called Field to Factory, which was all about that. And for the first time introduced the idea of kind of costumed living history in the exhibit space, which is not something that the Smithsonian has traditionally ever done, right? You know, they have exhibits, you go through and you see it. But here we had like little vignettes that we worked up actually in, you know, in the exhibit space. Like we had to be really careful to be there, but don't like touch anything, you know, the sort of display of a house and, you know, sort of like that chair is okay to touch, but that one is definitely not okay to touch, you know, and that kind of idea. And so, and we would move around the exhibit because they would have, you know, something, sharecropper shack kind of idea in one spot. And then, you know, at the other end of the exhibit was like a Chicago train station. And, you know, Eric turns into an Irish cop for this, you know, for that kind of thing. So it was really, I mean, it was a really phenomenal experience. We, you know, the office where we worked out of had a bunch of Superman props in it, just sort of sitting on shelves. And the big, the big cool thing was the original MASH sign, you know, the big multi-pointing, you know, Toledo,
cool.
You know, 7,000 miles away sign. Was just sitting behind my desk. I mean, it was, you know, which is not to say that they were not careful about their care, but because they're moving things in and out of exhibit so quickly, you know, they sort of have a storing, you know, a storage area. So that was pretty cool.
So you mentioned one of the Smithsonians, but there's about 474 Smithsonians, right? Like, it's not one museum. It's a series of, because you've already actually you mentioned two, because you mentioned a zoo and natural history. What else is
so there are
19, American history?
So yeah, there are actually 19 Smithsonian sort of official Smithsonian museums, one zoological park, so the National Zoo, and then a series of basically research centers of various kinds. There's a tropical research center in Panama and a Chesapeake Bay kind of research center that they run as well, which are not, you know, sort of open to the public the same way. But, and we'll probably get into that more, this balance that the Smithsonian has between being a research institution and being a public facing, you know, sort of display institution of some nature. But again, the 19 kind of is the count of museums about, I figured out, 8 of them are art or art and design museums, and the rest are a combination of various kinds of cultural ones or historical and some topical ones, natural history, air and space, that kind of thing.
And other than those ones that are outside, most of them are in DC, right?
Most are in DC, but not all. Like the George High Museum, which is part of the National Museum of American Indian, is in New York, as is the Cooper Hewitt Design Museum. Now it's called the Design Museum. It's like Smithsonian Design Museum, something like that, Cooper Hewitt. That's in New York as well. And then they also have a bunch of Smithsonian affiliate museums. So there's more than 200 museums around the country, which are, they sort of have partnered with the Smithsonian in a formal, we're going to call it the, you know, we're going to formally affiliate with the Smithsonian. And so they get to use the Smithsonian logo, and there's exchanges of stuff that they put on exhibit and expertise exchanges and that kind of thing. So if a
listener is listening somewhere outside of DC, they may very well be close to a museum
affiliated with the Smithsonian.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. So yeah, I think the, there's more than 200 of those, and in almost all 50 states, also Panama and Puerto Rico. So
cool.
Yeah.
Now, Eric, was the Smithsonian something that the framers of the U.S. Constitution and the creation of this country, is this something that they had in mind, or did it arise later on?
Basically, it arose later on. That's sort of an interesting way of phrasing it. Like, did they have this in mind? Because, of course, so many of the founders and sort of the next generation, right after, so the children of the founders, quote unquote, were deeply interested in sciences, you know, mostly sciences and sort of the useful arts, as they would call it. So, you know, this idea of technology development.
I mean, we're talking, three, four generations removed from the Enlightenment era, right?
Right.
You know, this idea that as you grew in wealth and status in society, okay, you had the time, and quite obviously, because you are smart human beings, you have the mental faculties to observe nature, okay, to measure, collect, make innovations, etc. So, you know, as part of that founding generation, you had individuals like, you know, Ben Franklin and others who were, of the philosophy, you know, if you had status in society, you had a responsibility to study what was going on, because again, you're a human being, and Enlightenment era thinking was the use of our mental faculties will allow us to observe and eventually control and change our environment.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
Jefferson with his agricultural work. Okay. I mean,
trying
to hybridize plants and figuring out crop rotations and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, okay. You know, sort of the fundamental idea of a contribution of useful knowledge, right? Like,
you want to
help the nation grow and sort of become independent. And of course, there was still this contrast with Europe, like, you know, Europe all fancy, you know, with their fancy museums and scientists, and young America ready to rise up and do that. So,
but we don't have the Smithsonian.
Correct. Right. Okay. So what we do have is in Washington, sort of as the seat of government, almost wherever the seat of government was at any given time, there was typically a group of people who was really interested in sort of getting together to talk about science and the useful arts and these kinds of ideas.
Oh, like a Royal Society sort of.
Exactly. I mean, you know, sort of a nascent Royal Society or a local version of the Royal Society. And in DC, there are a couple of them. One of the big ones was the Columbian Institute. And it was formerly the Columbian Institute for the Promotion of Arts and Sciences. Again, this kind of idea. And that was one of the big leading lights of that, was also a leading light of the development of the Smithsonian, was John Quincy Adams. So, you know, former president, John Quincy Adams, now representative again from Massachusetts.
Which you would never do now.
Yeah, I mean,
presidents now would never say, I'll just take a job being a representative in the House. That's such a different concept, because now we have presidents that do other things instead of, oh, sure, I'll be local dog catcher, whatever, it's fine with me, and I just want to serve.
So many of my students, when we talk about the founding era, okay, you know, some, you know, they'll ask questions like, well, you know, whatever happened to, you know, so-and-so who participated in the Constitutional Convention? I'm like, well, they went back home and they were governor. And they were like, well, wasn't that like a step down? And I'm like, no, that's just what you did back then, right?
Right.
If you were a member of societal elite, okay, and you didn't have to, you know, work your fingers to the bone at a farm, okay, it was expected that you would continue to serve, right?
Right.
You know, right. So, I mean, you know, think about John Quincy Adams, right? His father was John Adams, okay? So, you know, and he became president, John Quincy did, okay, in one of the most disputed elections in 1824. And when he lost his reelection against his opponent, Andrew Jackson, okay, he wasn't done with politics, right? He wasn't done with politics. He still thought he had something to give. Well, what, you know, what position was available? Well, you could run for Congress, right? But today, as Neil points out, you know, was Barack Obama going to go ahead and step down after being president? Okay, and run
and then
for
go
the
back to the Senate.
Senate, you know, representing Illinois.
Right? Yeah, he's not going to do that.
I mean, yep. You know, Bush 43 paints, right?
Right.
Okay.
And in fairness, paints pretty well.
Pretty well.
I'm pretty impressed with some of those portraits. His portrait of Madeleine Albright is actually quite lovely. I know this is a lame question, but I'm going to ask you, Eric, and you may not know the answer, but I'm going to ask anyway. Colombian named for Columbus?
I assume, I don't actually know that, but that was such a common naming in the era, you know, this idea of, you know,
or the District of Columbia.
Columbia, exactly. I mean, this District of Columbia, the Columbian Institute. I mean, for all I know, the Columbian is just because it was the District of Columbia, but more likely it's because that's the embodiment of the spirit of the United States kind of idea. This Columbia was often held in this era.
Adventurer and explorer and
okay.
So I mean, I was just clarifying, it's not because of the country Columbia, which probably
probably
yes, not that these,
yes to be
okay.
clear on that so
then that's in
institute.
The what, early 1800s or
yeah
so?
So that's, it was sort of founded in 1816. It became chartered by Congress as a sort of like, we recognize this as a real thing. They got a 20-year charter from Congress in 1818. And one of the things that, or a couple of the things they were really pushing for were things like a botanic garden and a museum of, you know, natural objects from the nascent United States, you know, and sort of North America, interested in
all the cool countries objects. Had one.
So, right, exactly. I mean, so they were starting to push for, exactly. They're starting to push for that kind of idea.
And again, for listeners, remember, we're talking about the 18 teens and the 1820s. Okay. The United States as a country basically existed east of the Mississippi, right?
Right.
So, I mean, when you're talking about, you know, the natural history of the United States of America, okay. We're not talking about the size and scope of the United States today, right? This would be a much more limited endeavor.
Right. Right?
Modest. Okay? This would be a modest endeavor.
15 years after Lewis and Clark, right? I mean, this is, Lewis and Clark had just sort of gone west. So they know there's this vast west out there. But they have no idea what's in it. Thomas Jefferson thought there were still mastodons out there. I mean, like, it's quite a kind of an opportunity
cool?
to learn a lot.
Yeah. That would have been cool, though, if there had been mastodons out there.
Totally.
I'm just
cool.
saying.
So, jumping forward into the 1830s, this is where it really gets interesting / strange.
Right. Yes. So that is a great way to phrase it, because enter James Smithson into this. So
Smithson.
Yeah. So Smithson, who unexpectedly gave the United States a bunch of money that we had no idea what to do with. So James Smithson, a naturalized British subject. He was actually born in France, an illegitimate child of a duke and the cousin of his wife, the duke's wife. And so James Smithson, his original last name was Muncie, I think, as I recall, and then eventually changed to Smithson sort of as he entered Oxford or when he was in Oxford. But yeah, he was raised in France, very much a sort of child of Enlightenment Europe in a lot of ways. I mean, his family had money, this Duke and his mother's family, and really he was raised by his mother, and her family had money as well. And so he ended up coming back to the UK because, I mean, his parents were British, and was naturalized there, went to Oxford, went to Pembroke College in Oxford, and studied chemistry, which was like the bleeding edge of natural history work of science at the time. And when he got through Oxford, he was sort of famous for being a pretty strong mind, pretty interested in this stuff, but not like a leading light. I mean, he was just a very solid kind of natural history scientist type. And of course, the tradition in the time was to go on the continental tour of Europe when you were wealthy. And he did it a little oddly in that he went to visit lots of scientists. Like, he wasn't there to see royalty or royal spaces or that kind of thing. Excuse me. Also allergies. So he, you know, started a big correspondence with sort of leading scientists of the era, and eventually inherited his mother's family's money. And interestingly, so in 1826, I guess he wrote his will, which also the year Thomas Jefferson died. But his original plan was to leave his money to his nephew. His brother had died. His brother had a son. He was going to leave him the money. Had made provision for like a servant of his own to get some money, and then the rest of this big inheritance was going to go to his nephew. But there was a provision in his will that said, if my nephew dies and has no heir of his own, then this money will go to the United States of America to found an institution for the increase and diffusion of knowledge, you know, called the Smithsonian Institution.
But so why the U.S.?
That's the mystery. It is actually really like, you know, I've looked at
several places. Had he been to the U.S.?
He had never been to the U.S. He owned 3 books that referenced the United States. Like, I mean, you know, I'm sure others did, but they weren't really, you know, and they weren't about.
Okay, guys, there's a movie plot there.
Yeah.
Okay, I think the 3 of us should go ahead and write it.
We submit there's to a got Hollywood to be studio.
Yes.
An American woman involved in this somehow. Don't you think?
That would there's, be epic.
There's so. Like there's a Wallace Simpson figure in here somewhere or something where he was like, America, it's the land of milk and honey or whatever.
That's right.
Regardless of having never been here. Okay.
Yeah. All so right. Apparently, I mean, the sort of 2 leading theories, one is that he, because he was illegitimate, as they would say, that he was never accepted into British society the way he would have liked, right? Or into the sort of the establishment the way he wanted. So he sort of resented that and therefore left this money to the United States. The other theory is just the sort of broad sense that, of course, was starting to percolate through Europe, which was that the United States was this sort of bastion of freedom and democracy. And, you know, he was really interested in the, you know, revolutionary France, I mean, movements in that direction. So it could be either of those things. It could be both those things. So
he never married?
He never married. Yes, he never married.
Or it could be an American man.
It could be
that sparked exactly. his interest so, yes. in the oh
yeah
see yeah, I want that movie
yeah see there that's that would be
that's even more fabulouser
so, yeah yeah that'd be great
okay but, so he so, says so, this so, is never gonna happen because my right. nephew's not gonna
right because my nephew's young me.
This is not gonna happen but in yeah. case it does
right
I'm gonna take a wild hair and say America It seems right. like a good place for
and
my
that kind of seems to be the extent of it. I mean, like, that's just like the end of his will. It's not, you know, there's no
XOXO Smithson.
James out. So
there wasn't this like huge introduction where he goes ahead and explains, okay, why he would like the United States to receive this chunk of cash, right?
Exactly.
You know, today, you know, we have all kinds of lead-ins before we even like order a cup of coffee, right? You know,
oh, yeah.
Tell you why I want this coffee.
Yeah, he didn't even provide that, right? Yeah. Okay. So how much money are we talking about?
Well, that's what's interesting. So there was a whole debate about, in the first place, whether we could even accept that money. Like, that happened in Congress, the president, you know, because there was this whole like, you know, oh, people are just trying to buy influence in the United States. I mean, that was a whole thing.
They're buying clout.
So, yeah.
Oh my gosh, back in the day, buying clout. Okay.
Yeah. In the end, they decided it was possible, right? Like, we could receive this money.
Yeah.
Because back then, we're not
going to take somebody's money. Come on.
Yeah. Because back then, you know, we earned money the old fashioned way. We inherited it, right? No, I mean, come on. Right?
Come on.
Okay.
Get it from a gift.
So, let me make sure timeline I understand this. So, he makes this will, not expecting this to be a thing. His nephew dies.
Right.
Is his death and his nephew's death close in proximity? Like, could he have changed the will and he just thought, I'll just leave it the way it is?
Yeah, I think his nephew lived about 6 years after he did. So what I don't really know is whether, like, I mean, did he receive that money in the meantime? I get the sense that he did, but somehow the will still encumbered the money. Like, James Smithson's will won out over, I guess, anything his nephew might have said. And maybe it was maybe he never received it. It was still actually in, in a bank somewhere.
Trust. Yeah.
Exactly. It was put into a trust. That's exactly right. So,
how much money are we talking about?
So, well, when we finally said, yes, we'll take it, we sent somebody over to get it. They collected it, of course, as like bags of gold coins from the UK, brought it back to
like
the
US. You do.
Yeah, exactly. Brought it back again, melted it down.
As part of a movie plot, okay, there would be like a half a dozen different chase scenes, okay, groups trying to steal the money, okay.
But it's all in carriages, ride through the streets, and people having to jump out of the way. And, oh my gosh, yes. And carriages bouncing out, yeah.
So we're talking about gold coins, gold sovereigns.
Yeah, 106,000 or 104,960 gold sovereigns, which were brought here, and, you know, because we're the U.S., immediately melted down and turned into coins here. Because, you know, come on.
So how much does that amount to?
So that was roughly $500,000 at the time, which is a really interesting kind of thing to say, because you could look at that as being two very different amounts of money. That's, you know, kind of an immediate recalculation, you know, with inflation, all that kind of stuff, to about $12 million. As a percentage of GDP, it's like $220 million. So it sort of depends on how you look at that amount of money.
Yeah.
It's really hard to do a comparison, a sort of one-to-one comparison to something that far back. But
it was a princely sum of money. It was a princely
sum of money. And another way to look at it is Harvard University, which had been around for 200 years, had an endowment of about $500,000 at the time that this rolled in as fresh money, bam, for a new institute, you know, for the increase in diffusion of knowledge, which of course didn't mean anything to anybody. Like, what is that?
The diffusion of knowledge. What? Okay, so let me.
Wait a minute. Hold on, just a second. Oh. Hold on, just a second, Ian. What is, of like all of our early presidents, the fact that the money came to the United States when Andrew Jackson was president, this just kind of sort of dawned on me. Andrew Jackson was our first quote unquote populist president. He distrusted elites. He certainly distrusted this idea that there was expert knowledge that could be developed, grown, etc. Of like all of our early presidents to be running the country to receive this gift with the mandate of, you know, growing, you know, our knowledge base. Oh my goodness. I bet Andrew Jackson was just like, huh? Like what?
Like, do it for why?
We want to spend a huge chunk of change about this. Okay. I just became president by basically saying that any normal American male, okay, can occupy any government position. You don't need to be smart. You don't need to be an expert, and you certainly don't need to be wealthy, okay, to do a government job.
Which may be why there was even some debate about whether you wanted to take it or not.
Right.
Yeah. Right. Because I don't want your stupid money with whatever strings come attached to it. So you get a five, let's just say, let's for the sake of math, say $500,000.
Okay.
What I would do is take that $500,000 and I would invest it into something that would give me a percentage that I could live on. Like, this is my dream if I ever win the lottery, right? If I ever win the lottery, I will put it into like a money market account that makes me X percentage, and I will live off of that so that I can do philanthropic things with the rest of the money.
Yeah, because Eric, so
is that how that...
Eric, you're talking to two people in the podcast who are fiscally conservative, right? Right. Okay, reasonable. We are very, very, you know, conservative fiscally, right?
Right.
So both me and I subscribe to the, you know, the thought process that if somebody wants to go ahead and give us a huge, okay, bag of coins, okay?
Gold sovereigns.
We're going to go ahead and invest it in probably the safest securities and instruments, okay?
Right.
And just live off the interest. Otherwise, exactly. Leave the principal alone. Is right. that what the United States did with this?
Well, basically, yes, but so they tried to do that. The Treasury did invest this money while Congress is trying to decide what to do. And that's where I sort of started to wander into was like, they didn't know what this institution was going to look like yet. We'll talk about that in a second. So while that wrangling was going on, they invested it in basically state government bonds for the state of Arkansas. So
why Arkansas?
I actually don't know that. I would guess because it's available.
Why United States? Yeah. All of this is a crapshoot. Apparently, right. Somebody right. picked up a set of dice, rolled it, and said, Arkansas looks good. Arkansas
is the way to do it.
And I'm not trying to be dismissive of, right. of the state of Arkansas.
They're lovely.
Okay, they're lovely. But of all the states at that time,
why them?
Okay, they would have a robust municipal or state bond structure in place. Arkansas doesn't jump out at me, right? New York does.
New York or Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania or Massachusetts.
Connecticut.
But Arkansas? But
yeah,
I mean, it's a really interesting question. Is it because what they wanted to be able to do was support the development of this young state, you know? But unfortunately, they defaulted on... on the bonds, and that royally pissed off, if I may use that word in this podcast,
please,
John Quincy Adams, who was like the protector of this money and the idea of what this money might become. And so this is when, you know, he sort of marshaled all his political forces and ultimately convinced the government to not only sort of back all that money, replace all that money, but also you know, all the interest that it would have earned as well. All that ended up when the Smithsonian was formally founded. That was part of the founding of it, was this sort of agreement that we're gonna pull all that money from the U.S. Treasury and sort of give it to this new institution that this money should have gone to in the first place.
So now we have the institution and we have this sort of what I think of must be treated now like an endowment, right? Like,
right.
I'm assuming that the Smithsonian has an ongoing endowment. They don't just spend all their money every year and then they don't have any money. I'm assuming they have what Augie and I would call safe investments. Like, they probably bought IBM, You know right. what I mean? Like companies that aren't yeah. gonna really go high, or like they're not into Bitcoin probably.
Right,
the Smithsonian's right. not gonna invest in crazy things, not crazy things, adventurous things.
Yeah, no cryptocurrency for the Smithsonian. Right.
They're gonna do the blue chip 500. These companies will only go under in the end times kind of. Investing, is that kind of how they maintain
ultimately do fund themselves, you know. I mean, they do invest this and they do run off the you know, not dipping into the principal, you know, they just run themselves for a while, you know, doing exactly as you describe. The problem, of course, has always been that has never been enough to run the whole thing. But their first secretary, Joseph Henry, did sort of make that a point, you know, like this is an investment. So we will, you know, not dip into the principal. We'll just continue to operate. But then they also had to raise money, and Congress ended up giving appropriations. And you know, modern Smithsonian is like 62% of the operating budget is through congressional appropriations annually. So it was $1 billion the last go round.
Okay.
So and then the
rest is made up from their investments and their
endowment and a lot of what they call now Smithsonian Enterprises, which is, you know, the shops and the restaurants and the
brand
catalogs and you know, and all that. Kind of, okay. Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this, without getting too far into the budgetary aspect.
Yeah.
Is the Smithsonian appropriations from Congress a controversial line item?
It's one of those things that like is and isn't. Okay. It has its defenders in Congress who will support it, I think, you know, whole hog, and its detractors in Congress, right? The people who think it's dumb to spend this money on, you know, anything that's not a Defense Department need, you know, or that kind of idea, right? Like, you know, they really don't want to see money going to cultural support. And so I think every, you know, at a certain level, every year it's a debate. Also, because the Smithsonian is so publicly popular, they're probably never going to really slam it. But what does happen is it grows faster than the appropriations can support. And so it is always running at a kind of deficit, basically. And that was like a big thing through a big chunk of its history. Again, we've talked about that later, was this sort of deficit mindset that they just always had to use. Like they basically never had enough money. Curators always had to realize that they had to, like, you know, cut costs where they could and that sort of thing. So,
so when was it officially created as an institution?
So August 10th, I believe it was 1846, was when the result of all this debate. So there was about a decade's worth of Congress saying, no, we should build a university. Like, you know, there was all this back and forth that kept happening, and it would kind of pop up and fade away as people
God
tried
bless
to
advocate. Congress.
Okay, wait, no, yeah. no. Yeah. I'm going to defend Congress in this.
For sure.
Which I rarely do, because usually my approval of my approval rating of Congress is usually about of my approval rating of the flu. But in this particular instance, they were given an endowment that said for the diffusion of knowledge.
Right.
Like, that's like saying, I'm going to give you an endowment for, you know, space. Like, what does that mean?
Right.
I appreciate Congress wanting to fight about that, because it's not a small amount of money. It is not a small investment. So right. if you're going to
well,
do something,
and moreover, Nia,
diffusion of knowledge could be a university. That makes sense, right? Like,
well, to your point, Nia, Eric, correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, in the history of the Smithsonian, there has been a debate about what should be its overarching purpose, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, I mean, because on one hand, for many of us, I mean, much like you, I mean, as a kid, I did field trips to the Smithsonian. We weren't going there for the diffusion of knowledge. We were looking at the cool artifacts, right? And okay, so on one hand, is it a museum or is the purpose to go ahead and do worthwhile research, right?
Right. And that tension, actually, so, you know, and it makes sense, right? The phrase was the increase and diffusion of knowledge. Increase, kind of research method, you know, the research purpose, right? The increase of knowledge. Diffusion is sort of the public facing purpose. And that had all, I mean, like really from the very beginning, from before they even said it, exactly as you said, Nia, they were trying to figure out what that means. And so a university was proposed, a national library was proposed, which again made a ton of sense. I mean, yes, there was a Library of Congress, but of course it was seen as like the library for Congress. Right. It was not the public,
that it has become.
That it has become. Yeah. And one of the great phrases was, I guess there was a university college professor who wanted a kind of a postgraduate university for, you know, with this money. And John Quincy Adams hated that and said, as I had to look over to see, his critique of the guy was that his very breath is pestilential, you know, for suggesting this terrible idea of a university, because there was this whole sense of like, you know, we can't use this money to educate, like to educate our children, to educate people, or to, you know, either, because another idea was more like a teacher preparatory kind of, you know, the idea, teach the teachers, right? And again, it all makes sense. None of it is, you know, really outre, but then there was, you know, what they ended up with. So in 1846 was taking some of these ideas and proposing kind of a combination museum, lecture area, laboratories kind of idea. But even then, once they articulated that in the founding, you know, the Congressional Act that found it. So they didn't, what was I just about to say with that? They still, of course, didn't really know what it was going to look like. So it was really the first secretary, Joseph Henry, who gave it shape in the end as to what exactly the Smithsonian, like he rolled out with a plan for, you know, okay, this is what the Smithsonian's going to end up doing now that we have it.
Well, thank goodness he had a vision.
So yeah, he had a vision. It did not particularly include a building, which is part of, like, he didn't want to use this money for a building because he's like, all that's going to do is eat up this money, right? Like if we have this money, nor did he particularly want a library. I guess I may not have mentioned that. That was one of the elements, was not, you know, the library, but a library, like a national library. And they had decided that every, you know, as happens now with Library of Congress, right? Like everything that gets copyrighted in the US, a copy of it shall be deposited at the Smithsonian Library and at the Library of Congress. Like that was part of this sort of thing. And after sort of the first decade of the Smithsonian's existence, Henry, who never liked the idea of the library, nor did he like the librarian that was hired, managed basically to get the librarian fired, and that library got moved to the Library of Congress as the Smithsonian Library at the Library of Congress. And so he's like, best of both worlds, we get the credit and we're, you know, but we don't have to take care of this library anymore. One of the, you know, so what did happen with this money in part was, of course, the establishment of the institution, and how it's managed through a board of regents and that sort of idea. You know, and money set aside for a building, which he didn't particularly want, but he recognized that it sort of needed to happen. And so that building ended up becoming the Smithsonian Castle, which we've talked about a little bit. So
called the castle because of the turreted top, right? Or the crenellated top.
Right.
What is in the castle?
It is formally, I think, the Smithsonian Institution building, but nicknamed the castle because it is sort of Norman in its design. And what's funny is that the founding legislation talks about, you know, a building made of plain materials without much ornamentation. I mean, this kind of sense. And I was like, and they ended up with a castle. I mean, it's not a complicated castle. It's not very ornate, but it's still a castle, which was a totally impractical for Joseph Henry's purposes, an impractical space. He did have living quarters there, his family, like he lived in the castle. What basically ended up happening was in all these towers of the castle, which weren't good for labs or research or display lectures, anything like that. They did house scientists. So there were people who were living in the castle. I mean, Joseph Henry had like his family's wing kind of idea. And then they would just house scientists kind of all around the castle, which led in the mid 19th century to like my favorite group of Smithsonian people, but we can talk about that later on, the Megatherium Club.
Which I want to be a member of because that's an awesome name.
It's a great name.
So what's in the castle? The castle now is the administration part, isn't it? Isn't it sort of like the...
The big thing that's there now, I mean, there is administrative offices, but also now the visitor center, like finally, like it is now relatively recently become the, like, come here first, you know, learn about all the Smithsonian museums, figure out what you want to do. They have exhibits kind of from all the museums, like, you know, just little teaser exhibits in there to let people know.
One ruby slipper.
Right, and, exactly.
No, I'm kidding.
Can you find the other one?
Sorry, that's my like the memories that I have of the Smithsonian, right? Of a lot of the television stuff, Archie Bunker's chair, and then the movie stuff, and a few years ago, the American flag.
Oh, sure,
which is stunning, and it's being refurbished. That's the wrong word. Sort of, but you
know, renovated is too strong a word. Too,
yeah, I don't know exactly what, but I mean, it's being preserved and it's amazing. Like it's an amazing sort of breathtaking. You step in and you go, whoa, okay, that's really old and really cool, which is what happens with a lot of the exhibits at the Smithsonian, right? The Smithsonian is like, if you've never been to the First Lady's gowns exhibit, it's really interesting. Like, it's just an interesting walk through history of this is what these women had to wear in order to be the public face of the wife of the government, basically, right? Like,
yeah, the first lady of the government. I mean, you know, that's how they're, you know, oftentimes described. But I mean, again, those kinds of materials, okay, don't age well unless they are preserved and protected.
Right.
Okay. So, you know, and in part, that's the diffusion of knowledge, right, Eric? I mean, you know, you have these displays in part that go ahead. I mean, and again, it's kind of sort of like our discussion with Christy Artello about, you know, art, right? I mean, one of the values or purposes of art is to go ahead and show, okay, how things have changed. What was important in a particular period of time? Why did they start viewing things this way and depict them this way, right? So when you go to the Smithsonian and you see that kind of display, you're just like, wow, they forced women to wear this, okay? And they were supposed to go ahead and look.
And smile. Know,
Smile.
And they're supposed to smile the while they're wearing that. Like, it's one thing to make me wear it. It's another thing to make me enjoy it.
Right.
You know, or Julia Child's kitchen. Like, that is enormous touchstone thing for women taking on an entirely different kind of cooking.
Right.
And then you follow on with that exhibit and you realize she's also a spy, right? So it's this whole empowerment thing that's very different and can, there's a lot of things that are like that in, to my mind, in the Smithsonian, which are, they start off as one thing, but then as you explore more, you find the layers and the depths and all of a sudden you're like, whoa, this is crazy.
Right.
But I hate to stop us here, but we need to stop here for a minute and come back if we can for another episode to finish up because.
Oh, I'd love to.
Okay.
Yeah, so I mean, I think, Eric, we would like for you to come back and discuss how the Smithsonian expanded and grew. Its value and purposes perhaps have changed, maybe some of the controversies, because as many of us who have followed the Smithsonian can note, there have been some controversies about some of the displays. Okay.
Indeed. Yeah. Yeah. No, that'd be great. Yeah.
So absolutely. You're willing to come back for a second episode? To. Okay. Happy great. To.
Fabulous. Okay. Thanks so much, guys.
Thank you, Nia.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Civil Discourse, brought to you by VCU Libraries. Opinions expressed are solely the speaker's own and do not reflect the views or opinions of VCU or VCU Libraries. Special thanks to the workshop for technical assistance. Music by Isaac Hobson. Find more information at guides.library.vcu.edu/discourse. As always, no documents were harmed in the making of this podcast.